I can only imagine how much the oncology fellows at MD Anderson Cancer Center enjoy making rounds with Dr. Robert Wolf, who met with me to discuss emerging research to practice issues in colorectal cancer. Dr. Wolf began by discussing the issue of identification of patients with potentially surgically curable metastatic disease.
There are patients we see now with newly diagnosed metastatic disease that we would have said a few years ago, there's no way they're ever going to get to an OR to deal with this metastatic component. And now we're sending some of those patients. And it's not everybody, but it's really changing who we think about for surgery. And it's not just liver confined. I mean, you know, we'll now sort of say, okay, we'll go after the liver. Yeah, we see that he's got a pulmonary nodule, but, you know, we may deal with that too. And these may not be curative strategies, but they are part of a strategy of stretching out the clock. We need to think about metastatic disease as hopefully a marathon, and it's not a race. You know, I think what happens a lot is you go from regimen A to regimen B to regimen C. There's no holidays. There's no, okay, he had a response. He's now got stable disease. Let's take off for 3 months. And I think doctors many times don't have the confidence to do that and just say, we're sitting tight. We're going to just scan you in 2 more months. And the patients I have who I think have done well, it's obviously partly biology. I mean, it's not just me. But part of it is we're willing to take a break and just sort of let things ride for a while. You can't do that if you have somebody with bad biology. But those are the patients we impact the least on. And I think doctors, oncologists, what the future is going to be, you get metastatic disease in your clinic. You have to think about, in a stepwise fashion, what are we going to do here? And not just, let's just plow through every regimen that we have. I think right now, we're starting to see a bit of a, I don't want to say kitchen sink, but I think, you know, let's add a VEGF inhibitor and an EGFR inhibitor and cytotoxic therapy, combined cytotoxic therapy, and try to maximize response. It may turn out that that's the best way to ensure prolonged survival. But it may be that we say, let's start with this cytotoxic chemotherapy and a VEGF inhibitor. And then in a sequential way, we're going to move to a second cytotoxic regimen, perhaps with a biologic, maybe not, and then a third line, and to have more of a let's have this strategy. And this may be punctuated for some, a subset of patients, but I think it's a growing subset of patients with surgical interventions. It gets complicated when you talk about hepatic resection, ablation. Those are things that I think, unfortunately, too many people, I guess, have the technology to use. I'm not convinced they have the wherewithal in terms of oncologic sense, how to use them, when to use them. But I think the really good oncologist is talking more to his surgical colleagues, or should be talking more to his surgical colleagues in a prospective way as they follow patients through their course of therapy or course of therapies. And really, this is where I think we need to start having docs think about these things as not just, well, you know, my brainstem says fulfoxavastatin, and when he runs out of that, we'll do this, as opposed to, well, let's sort of have a more longitudinal plan here. The other area that I don't want to say I'm discouraged, but it would be nice if surgeons didn't necessarily attack the primary in the face of metastatic disease. Because I think many of these patients, their primaries can respond to the combinations we now have. Back when I started as a GI oncologist, we would treat patients with a primary tumor in place with 5-FU-based therapy. The best we saw was the primary didn't get any worse. Now, I mean, I have several examples of patients with rectal cancer in particular where, you know, we're not interested in radiation necessarily at that point in time, who will respond to combination cytotoxic therapy with or without the biologics. I think the biologics can add to the response rate. And so the timing of surgery, the interventions that we actually put these patients through, I think is really going to be dynamic.
Maybe we can pick up on a few of these things specifically, starting with the idea of the synchronous primary and metastatic disease. In breast cancer, that happens occasionally, not as frequently. And a lot of times the way they approach it is the breast lesion then just becomes another lesion in terms of whether you decide to use surgery. If it's not causing a problem, you use it as an indicator lesion or you try to shrink it down. Is that kind of the way you all are starting to approach colon cancer?
I think so. I think the difference is, well, you know, a breast lump may lead to some psychological distress. I think it really helps women if they take a couple of courses of chemo and then they say, I can't feel it anymore. I think that's a very positive experience for a patient. With the colon, you have fewer clues that it's okay to leave it there. For instance, many times we'll get endoscopic reports that says the scope cannot be passed beyond this juncture. That is a signal to many surgeons in particular in the community, this is an obstructing lesion, it's got to come out. If you sit down with a patient, if you look at the CT scan, you will many times have the sense, this doesn't really appear to be obstructing. And it would be okay to at least cautiously proceed. But there's something where we really try to make sure our surgeons are plugged in with those patients, meaning that, hey, guys, we have a patient here, primary intact, significant metastatic disease, or a metastatic tumor burden that we would like to move on with therapy now, but stay tuned. We'll get back to you about surgery on the primary, surgery on the metastatic component. But, you know, we're going to toss in some bevacizumab, or this could go sour on us. Now, in my experience so far, none of those things have happened. I try to tell people that I think, at least theoretically, they may have an increased risk of a bowel perforation with a nasty primary in place. I don't think there's any data to really support that. But intuitively, you wonder, could this be harmful? But I think with breast cancer, as an example, other than the distress that a woman may have about a lump being there, you know, ulceration or something, but the colon, it's sort of an invisible site that the patient doesn't have good cues in terms of this is a problem for them.
And I'm sure that your approach is going to be different whether you think up front that maybe the patient's going to be candidate for curative surgery in the metastatic disease.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. And that's why I think I would like to see, at least when I see patients in the community, that the community oncologist and the surgeon have had some sort of huddle before we just go down a road that's not necessarily the right road for the patient. As an example, pretty good volume of metastatic disease, primary in place, yeah, maybe causing some problems, but not obstructing, not bleeding in a significant way, still goes to the OR. Now this patient has 6 weeks of recovery, and the metastatic component is just, you know, you're farther behind. It's very discouraging when we see those types of things happen, as opposed to let's be a little more prospective and circumspect in terms of how we're going to approach this. At our institution, obviously, we have patients come many times prior to surgery, but often post their primary resection. And those are totally different scenarios for us. For instance, I have a patient now who has a rectal lesion, fairly high, not causing obstruction, not causing any pain or bleeding. We have had some response to the metastatic component within his liver. It hasn't been dramatic, but it's been sufficient that our hepatic surgeon believes that he can go after that. Now, the primary is just sort of sitting there, and because we're a little concerned that if we do a chemoradiation component as the next step, we actually may lose ground in the liver. His first intervention, surgical intervention, is going to be for the metastatic component, and then we are going to backpedal, and then we're going to see what we do with the primary post-hepatic resection. That's not something that we would do with all patients. We have a tendency overall to do a two-stage procedure, meaning don't like to do colon or rectal resection same time as hepatic resection. There's a little more comfort lately doing that, but we still think of these as sort of staged procedures. And one of the advantages of that is you could actually punctuate that with some more systemic therapy in between if you needed to. Each patient is different. And I just think we try at our institution to get everybody involved in the same room or some sort of crosstalk that here's the initial plan. That plan may need to change, but here's our initial plan. And then sort of as the restaging dictates, et cetera, then you may modify that plan.
That's interesting, the case that you described. How old is the patient?
He's a young man. He's in his early 40s.
Yeah, I mean, when you describe that, I'm thinking to myself, young patient. Do you take this approach in the older patients also?
I think that's more variable. Let me just say, I think we're a little slower to pull the surgical trigger in an older patient with comorbidities. For instance, an older patient can certainly take a wedge resection. You have a single focus of metastatic disease of the liver. That's not a big deal. A trisegmentectomy, that's a big deal. And those are things you have to be fairly choosy about. As a general rule, just thinking out loud, I would say the older patient would have to show very favorable biology and have tolerated their cytotoxic therapy well. If you have an older patient who's a little borderline, who doesn't do well, you know, they get admitted with dehydration or problems related to cytotoxic therapy, the surgeons are not going to be too happy signing up to take that patient on. And so it's a combination of tumor burden, what would be the extent of surgery, and the hardiness of the older patient. We wouldn't upfront exclude an older patient, but you get past your late 60s, mid-60s is okay. You're getting into your late 60s, early 70s, you have to demonstrate a good reason that you've demonstrated this patient can take it. For instance, I have an older lady who had a stage 3 colon cancer, treated appropriately with adjuvant therapy. She then developed a single focus of metastatic disease that a outside surgeon did not believe was resectable, but ablatable. So she underwent an ablation. And she came to us with rim enhancement around the ablation site. And this is a difficult problem with ablation, is that many times in the sort of the margin of injury, but not necrosis, that's a very ripe environment for the tumor to sort of redevelop. And so she developed clearly progressive rim enhancement around her ablation site.
Markers going up also?
Her markers were going up. And I don't recall if we did a PET scan in that situation, but we actually watched it because her initial scan was equivocal. But at 2 months later, again, this is the sort of let's observe things, the enhancement became worse. There was clear progression of this margin of enhancement. She's 74 years old. She was given FOLFIRI and Avastin, tolerated it beautifully, and had a response. No hospitalizations, was able to, what I would call, walk through the chemotherapy. And between the response that she had and her tolerance of the chemotherapy, she, in fact, went to the OR at our institution and had this area resected. I can't speak to the technical issues. This was a technically challenging case. But in terms of her ability to get through the operation, she did great.
How long after the Avastin did you do the surgery?
We actually waited a period of time. It was, I think, 2 full months. And as a general rule, we like a 2-month interval. Now, that is somewhat different than pancreatic cancer, where we are starting to use some bevacizumab preoperatively. I'm not particularly comfortable having somebody sit still for a full 2 months after a pre-op program. I actually think a 6-week interval for most patients is plenty of time. Certainly 2-4 weeks makes me nervous. 6-8 weeks is sort of the window we like.
And of course, you know, Lee Ellis from your place wrote the editorial in the JCO recently about this issue. And I think 6 weeks is what he said there too also. I'm curious also with the first patient you mentioned, the man in his 40s, did you give him a bevacizumab containing regimen?
Yes, he received FOLFOX bevacizumab and he had a very nice early response, but with continued therapy, he started to sort of just stabilize with the liver. And so we decided, well, we can do chemoradiation and then go after the liver, or let's just go after the liver now. So our choice has been to go after the liver now. The problem with chemoradiation is you're obviously backing off on your cytotoxic component. I mean, you simply can't continue FOLFOX in the face of radiation, at least not full-dose therapy from my view. And so that's why a decision was made in his case. The other thing I'll mention, Neil, and I think you're aware of this, the French group has demonstrated pretty nicely, although it's retrospective data, that patients whose metastatic component is responding to therapy when they go off for their hepatic resection have a better outcome than patients who have stable disease, and they do better who patients who are progressing, whose tumors are progressing in the liver in the face of therapy. And so we philosophically try to use that approach, meaning we like it when patients are responding to therapy prior to considering resection. That's not a hard and fast rule. Certainly in a younger patient where you're really trying to make the difference, you might take that approach. Again, your older patient who's a borderline surgical candidate, if they have progression within the liver in the face of cytotoxic therapy, the medical oncologist is going to be asked to try again before our surgeons would take such a patient on.
Getting back to this issue of the time from the bevacizumab to the surgery, because I think a lot of oncologists might find that a little bit daunting to think about. Do you try to get more chemo in between?
So that's exactly right. So what we will often do, I mean, we typically would tell somebody to give 4 doses of FOLFOX and Bev. And so do the Bev with the first 3, lay off the 4th, then they come back for restaging. And then if we like things, we'll wait another few weeks and take them downtown. If we say, okay, we still would like to see a little more movement here, then perhaps another cycle or two at home or with us. But that's exactly what we do, is if we're not comfortable continuing the Bev, but we still need a little more time elapsed before surgical intervention, that's exactly how we would do that.
The 74-year-old woman who had the surgery, do you think that if she had initially come to you all, you would have gone right to surgery rather than the ablation which she had in the community?
I think what we would have done is given her a combination therapy. Her adjuvant therapy was 5-FU and leucovorin. I think we would have given her a couple of months, perhaps 3 months of cytotoxic therapy, and then done a hepatic resection thereafter. If you've talked to Steve Curley, I think you're probably aware that he has data with what we have done with MD Anderson in terms of patients who have been able to have hepatic resection combined with ablation, or ablation only as the means to deal with the metastatic component in the liver. The patients who do best have a resection. The patients who do worse have ablation only, and the patients who have a combination of resection and ablation are intermediate. So whenever possible, we're fans of resection, and if that's technically doable and you have enough hepatic remnant. And some of our hepatic surgeons like to do residual volumes and will do portal vein embolization to try to lead to some hypertrophy. I don't get involved in that. Those are their decisions. We try to work around if we want to give more chemotherapy after an embolization or not, etc. But patients are sometimes put through a portal vein embolization to lead to contralateral hypertrophy, so they're left with sufficient hepatic reserve after a big hepatic resection.
Interesting. The difference in approach, for example, in this case where you took one approach and the patient actually received another one prior to getting to you, I think it reflects another issue, which is sort of quality control in terms of management of hepatic metastases across this country. How does an oncologist in practice sort of decide they've got a patient, they think, you know, surgery or ablation might be sort of a consideration, sort of when they're dealing with a surgical team that really is able to deal with it? Do you think these patients should go to tertiary centers?
I always encourage that. Obviously, that's a difficult thing to insist upon, but I think people who do this day in and day out, there are two components to this, Neil, as you can imagine. There's the technical component, but there is an oncologic component that just because you have a machine that can put holes in the liver and kill tumor nodules doesn't necessarily mean that's the right intervention for an individual patient. And I think it's surgical judgment. It's what I call oncologic judgment, because surgical judgment to me is, can I resect this or ablate this and get the patient through the operation? But oncologic judgment is this a viable strategy in terms of prolonging survival, or is this part of a curative strategy? And I think too many times, because we can do these things, we do them as opposed to this is what we should do.
I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the research that sort of touches into this issue of interdisciplinary care. First, I'm curious about your thoughts about NSABP C09 that's looking at patients who have, I guess, hepatic resection or ablation, looking at the question of does intrahepatic FUDR add to Xelox, which is sort of given as an adjuvant afterwards. What are your thoughts about that study?
Well, I was wondering if intra-arterial therapy would come up today. I think that these types of strategies are still a component of how we approach individual patients.
Do you guys do it?
Well, I guess I would say we do it on a limited basis. It's usually not part of routine adjuvant therapy. What I find interesting about the Kemeny data from a few years ago is when it was initially submitted as an abstract, the patients who appeared to have the most benefit had the greatest number of lesions resected from their liver. So, for instance, the group that had four or more hepatic lesions were the ones who seemed to be deriving the most benefit from having an intra-arterial pump. And the way I've thought about that is those patients are not truly oligometastatic. They sort of really have more diffuse disease. And in such a patient, perhaps the pump will have more effect in terms of hepatic control of small volume metastatic, micrometastatic disease in the hepatic remnant compared to cytotoxic systemic therapy. As a general rule, because these systemic therapies have improved, we have in a routine way used the intra-arterial pump as an adjuvant. Having said that, again, if you have a patient who's a little bit of a borderline patient, a number of lesions that are going to have to be addressed, I wouldn't necessarily say we're not going to put a pump in that patient. The other area where I've used a pump in my own practice is typically after failing first or even second line cytotoxic therapy, where you know the chances of response are only 10 or 15%. We haven't published data, but we still see roughly a 30 to 40% response rate to intra-arterial therapy in the second and third line setting. And that's fairly impressive when really in second and third line setting now we're talking 10, 15, perhaps 20% response rates. So in terms of the intra-arterial therapy as part of an adjuvant strategy, I have no personal problem with that. I think there's going to be a subset of patients who are more likely to benefit from having a pump, and whether the C09 brings that out, I'm not clear on. And the pump is not a benign intervention. And one of the issues is there's a learning curve to dosing pumps. There's a learning curve to putting pumps in. And I'm not exactly sure who they're allowing to participate in this trial. And that's a real issue because these are not just component parts you plug in and you dose. I know that Dr. Kemeny has an algorithm and they're going to follow an algorithm. But it's still a tricky business.
You know, it's interesting. Unfortunately, we had asked you to participate in our colorectal think tank this summer. I think you were tied up that weekend. But we had Norm Walmark there, and some of the participants kind of got on him a little bit about that trial, calling intrahepatic therapy a dinosaur, and why are they studying it. And one of the things that he mentioned that I thought was really interesting was that one of their interests is actually to develop a cadre of hepatic surgeons who can really participate in trials. That he thought that was actually more important than the study question. Moving forward, looking at what you've been talking about, curative therapy, can they develop a cadre of hepatic surgeons who can do standardized procedures and participate in research?
This is really necessary. And one of the issues that I actually tried to put together a trial some years back in terms of preoperative intra-arterial therapy prior to hepatic resection. This is back when irinotecan was just coming out and oxaliplatin was not even on the horizon. And one of the greatest difficulties we had in terms of putting such a trial together is what one surgeon considers unresectable versus another surgeon versus a third surgeon. And this whole idea of having a vocabulary and criteria for this is and this isn't. We struggle with this, as I'm sure you can understand, in pancreatic cancer in terms of defining resectability of pancreatic tumor, but at least we have some agreed upon radiographic criteria. It gets a little fuzzy with some of the arterial abutment issues. But I think the same problems exist for hepatic resection. And Dr. Wallmark's a fairly forceful person, and I think if he could put together an organization of hepatic surgeons, that would be actually progress in terms of doing some of these studies. We are looking at some preoperative programs within our institution. We're trying to get this done through also an NCI-sponsored trial. But one of the biggest difficulties is defining resectable or defining unresectable disease, because otherwise you have too much of a mixed bag.
Another thing that's interesting about the CO9 study is that they chose to use Xelox as their sort of adjuvant or systemic therapy and sort of jumped right to it. You know, there are trials out there trying to compare the two, et cetera. What are your thoughts about that regimen, utilizing it in trial and utilizing it in a non-trial setting?
I personally think there's enough data coming in now that most authorities would say that Xelox and FOLFOX are going to be close to equivalent. If they're not exactly the same in terms of efficacy, they're going to be pretty darn close. I think capecitabine has less attractiveness because of the existence of oxaliplatin, meaning if you need a central line anyway, why can't you put 5-FU through that line and your oxaliplatin and have someone take what I'll call a more intense course of 5-FU over 48 hours and be done for 12 days, as opposed to doing 2 weeks at home where you're relying on their compliance, etc., and a lot of people not necessarily being compliant. So if we were talking about 5-FU versus capecitabine, I think there would be a lot of physicians who would be favoring capecitabine over a 5-FU program. Now I think this is an individual physician choice, patient choice, but I personally don't have any problems using capecitabine with oxaliplatin as part of the standard adjuvant. I mean, the logic would be capecitabine is equivalent to 5-FU and leucovorin in the adjuvant setter, possibly a little bit better, certainly less toxic. FOLFOX is better than 5-FU and leucovorin in the adjuvant setting, and therefore Xelox, I think, is a reasonable adjuvant substitute.
What about Xelox or CAPOX plus bevacizumab in the metastatic setting?
Again, a very attractive program, and this is something that the AVANT trial is going to try to figure out, is would that be equivalent to FOLFOX-BEV? I think the most interesting question is, does bevacizumab add in the adjuvant setting? Theoretically, if bevacizumab is an anti-angiogenic therapy, you would say in microscopic metastatic disease, how much benefit could that drug give you? Lee Ellis, as you know, has been a strong proponent that bevacizumab is not simply anti-angiogenic therapy, it's anti-VEGF therapy. There is data that VEGF receptors are on the tumor cells and that VEGF may act as an autocrine growth factor for the tumor itself. And so if you inhibit that pathway, in fact, you may have a greater benefit in the adjuvant setting. But it's going to be really interesting, and I think anybody who tries to predict the result of that trial could be surprised. I think there may be a difference between having bevacizumab and no bevacizumab. I'll be quite surprised if there's a difference between FOLFOX bevacizumab, Xelox bevacizumab.
And of course, Paula Huff from your place is the PI on that really important international adjuvant study. You know, getting back to this issue of capecitabine and 5-FU and what you were just saying about oxaliplatin, another situation where this comes up, and your colleague Chris Crean was pretty, how can I put it, vocal about this in a JCO editorial a while back, is the question of capecitabine versus continuous infusion 5-FU as part of neoadjuvant therapy for rectal cancer. And he actually discussed this on one of our programs, felt like, for example, trials such as NSABP-R04 that's looking at that in a randomized fashion, although now I think they're looking at oxali also, was maybe not the best spend in terms of resources. What are your thoughts in the situation of neoadjuvant chemo radiation therapy of capecitabine versus 5-FU?
That's a very good question. And one of the issues that I think we need to recognize is that we can't study everything. We have to choose what are really important questions to answer. I personally don't think it's a really important question to decide, is capecitabine superior, inferior, equivalent to infusional 5-FU or bolus 5-FU? The Memorial Group has data for preoperative rectal cancer that whether you give patients bolus 5-FU with radiation or infusional 5-FU with radiation, the outcomes are equivalent, actually. I think the surprise came with the intergroup trial that showed infusional 5-FU as part of adjuvant therapy for rectal cancer was superior to bolus 5-FU. Part of that may have been how much bolus 5-FU people got. There are a lot of reasons why that study could be positive. But if we accept the Memorial data that there really is no difference between bolus 5-FU with radiation and infusional 5-FU with radiation as part of a pre-op strategy, I think it's very likely that capecitabine will not be necessarily inferior to infusional or bolus 5-FU. And if you get a speaker on your program who can give you a biological reason why it might be inferior, I'm all ears.
I can think of a lot of biological reasons might be better.
Understood. That hasn't necessarily been established from the studies that have been done thus far. But I really do think it is a very convenient drug to give with radiation to patients with rectal cancer. We are looking at it in upper GI tumors more, not so much esophageal, some gastric, certainly pancreatic, small bowel tumors. It is an easier way. We think we know how to dose it now. I just don't think in terms of resources and really nailing down this question, because I think to see a difference, you would need large numbers of patients. I mean, one of the areas that we haven't discussed today is I do believe the biologics will have a role as radiation sensitizers. And I think it's much more important to spend our resources investigating both their biologic activity as radiation sensitizers and the clinical endpoints as radiation sensitizers. And to try to argue this 5-FU capecitabine with radiation is just not something that gets me worked up.
You were talking before about the issue of convenience, and when you have oxali, you need a central line anyhow. What about in the neoadjuvant rectal setting, where obviously most of these people are not going to get oxali? How much of a quality of life difference or benefit is it to take capecitabine versus 5-FU?
People just don't like having a pump. Now, if you say you're going to do a pump as part of a FOLFOX or FOLFIRI regimen for 48 hours, that's different than saying you're going to wear this thing for the next 6 weeks. And there is baggage to those things. We've had pumps malfunction. We don't know how much 5-FU they've received, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you could also make the argument, well, you don't know how much capecitabine they're getting. There is a leap of faith in terms of relying on the patient to be compliant with the medication. At our institution, I think we do have a highly motivated group of patients, particularly when you're telling them this preoperative therapy may make the difference between you having a sphincter-preserving procedure or a colostomy, and I do think that's a strong motivator for many patients. So I just think it's a lot easier not to deal with a pump for several weeks, the catheter-related issues. The biggest issue is people could now make the argument, well, they may need oxaliplatin on the back end, although we don't really know how oxaliplatin fits in rectal cancer post-operative adjuvant therapy for rectal cancer. I think most of us feel fairly comfortable that if it adds a benefit for patients with stage 3 colon cancer, certainly it should add a benefit for patients with stage 3 rectal cancer. Now, one of the questions that if I were you, I'd be posing to me is, what is stage 3 rectal cancer? What do you base the patient being stage 3? So, for instance, a patient may start with an endoscopic ultrasound that shows them to have perirectal lymphadenopathy, and they have clinical stage 3 disease, no evidence of distant disease, and you treat them and you downstage them to a T2N0 lesion, what should their postoperative therapy be? We don't really know the answer to that.
When you say that T2N0, you mean pathologically?
Correct. So you've downstaged them from a clinical staging to a pathologic staging that is stage 2 or stage 1 rectal cancer. What is the role of postoperative therapy in those patients? Or what is the role of oxaliplatin in such a patient? Do they now need the oxaliplatin? In my practice, unfortunately, our pre-op regimens don't actually dictate what the postoperative therapy should be. But in a patient who presents with clinical stage 3 disease, I'm giving them oxaliplatin as part of their postoperative treatment, assuming there's no contraindication to the addition of oxaliplatin.
Regardless of what's seen at surgery.
Correct. Even a path CR, I think, would not sway me if somebody presented with stage 3 disease to give them oxaliplatin on the back end of the surgery. Now, we know prognostically that the patients who do downstage, particularly to path CRs, have excellent long-term survival. We still have at least hints of activity for more postoperative therapy. The numbers are too small to really make a strong statement, but it seems better to receive further postoperative systemic therapy than to just have your path CR and say you're all done with treatment.
And in terms, again, of non-protocol approaches, and I know your first choice is always going to be to try to get the patient on a study, are you using capecitabine in general in the neoadjuvant situation?
The answer is yes. And the question is, do you use capecitabine on the back end with your postoperative therapy? I typically do if I've given them capecitabine as part of the pre-op. So infusional 5-FU is really a thing of the past, both on protocol and off protocol at MD Anderson. I think there are still purists in the world who would say you don't have any data for that and you shouldn't be doing that. Again, I think if you can get someone on board here to come and tell you the biological reason why capecitabine is inferior to infusional 5-FU, I'd be very open to that discussion.
And I know that you all have a really interesting trial right now, neoadjuvant rectal trial. Can you talk about that?
Sure. It's a combination of capecitabine with bevacizumab given every 2 weeks during the course of their radiation. This is a trial that's fairly recently opened. I've just had a patient complete it. She had very nice downstaging from a T3 N1 situation, clinical staging based on endoscopic ultrasound. Just as a comment here, when patients are offered preoperative therapy, they are always put through an endoscopic ultrasound for T staging and node staging, unless CT clearly shows perirectal adenopathy. And you can stage them on the basis of the CT. CT is not as sensitive in terms of tumor stage or nodal status compared to endoscopic ultrasound. So virtually everyone, not everyone, but virtually everyone has an endoscopic ultrasound, and they are clinically staged on that basis. Then they receive the capecitabine with the bevacizumab. The bevacizumab and capecitabine start on the first day of the radiation, and then they receive the Bev Q2 weeks through 45 gray of radiation. They're given 6 weeks of rest, and then they are offered back to the surgeons. And in this patient I'm referring to, she had very nice downstaging. She didn't have a path CR, but she's down to T2N0 disease with only microscopic foci of tumor in the muscularis propria. You have to believe that woman is going to have a good prognosis. Having said that, she's in her mid-50s. She's otherwise healthy. There is no contraindication to giving her an oxaliplatin-containing regimen. And what we have done is given her what I call dealer's choice. So she can take Zelox on a 3-week schedule for 5 sessions, or she can take Folfox on a 2-week schedule for 8 doses. She hasn't decided. I mean, I think this is something where I think Zelox, the ox part is a little more intense on a 3-week basis, but it's, you know, you have 3 weeks to recover before your next dose. I don't think there's much toxicity difference between those two. And part of it is a style issue. Do you want to be hooked up to a pump 2 days every 14? Or do you want to take one pop of oxaliplatin and go on your way with your oral medication?
That's really an exciting study. And of course, you know, Chris Wellett did the study that a lot
beautiful
of people.
Beautiful study.
And I'm sure that was a big part of your rationale to look at this when he looked at 5-FU plus bevacizumab. And he did a lot of interesting tissue studies. Are you guys going to do anything like that?
We are not as part of this trial. You know, the support for doing those kinds of things is very difficult to come by. We have tried with our pancreas trial to do some CT perfusion studies, trying to get a feel for what bevacizumab does to tumor perfusion. In some of our patients, it does appear that giving bevacizumab increases tumor perfusion. Many people would say, well, that's not what you want bevacizumab to be doing.
Or what you expect it to do, sort of.
Correct. What we think happens is that the smaller immature capillaries and the intratumoral interstitial pressure go down, and that some of the larger blood vessels open up. But these are more mature, normal-appearing blood vessels, and that initially tumor perfusion goes up. But that provides greater oxygen delivery to the tumor bed, and that in and of itself, we would think, is a radiation-sensitizing maneuver.
And I guess chemo also.
Correct. I mean, this is one of the reasons why Ellis has been a strong proponent of saying bevacizumab is not necessarily anti-angiogenic therapy. I think that is a component of its activity. But bevacizumab is anti-VEGF therapy. And what it's doing in terms of allowing delivery of chemotherapy or enhancing oxygenation of tumor to provide greater radiosensitization, these are all issues that are still being worked out. But it's really a pleomorphic action on tumor and tumor microenvironment that bevacizumab is providing.
And he's also talked about maybe that there's an initial phase where you have greater perfusion that's only short-lived. So there's a dynamic thing over time.
Exactly. You know, you wonder, well, when's your biggest bang for your buck? We know that adding bevacizumab to cytotoxic therapy usually increases the response rate to the cytotoxic therapy. But we also know that progression-free survival is prolonged. And typically when patients respond, they respond in the early going, and then they have a stable phase. And what bevacizumab, I believe, is doing, or other VEGF inhibitors probably work to do, is to inhibit angiogenesis, and you stretch out the durability of your cytotoxic regimen.
What are your thoughts moving forward in terms of oxaliplatin as part of neoadjuvant therapy? The NSABP actually has now incorporated that as a second question into their trial. Do you think that this makes sense, and is that something you would consider in a non-protocol setting?
You're talking about for rectal cancer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we are looking at oxaliplatin as part of a chemoradiation program in anal cancer right now. I think we're still learning about the toxicities there. It's clearly an active regimen. Certainly in rectal cancer, I think it could increase your downstaging rate. It's, to me, partly a toxicity issue, but it's an important question. I mean, I think what we should recognize is that we have a lot of weaponry out there. We have fluoropyrimidines, 5-FU capecitabine. We have irinotecan, we have oxaliplatin, we have cetuximab, we have bevacizumab. We shouldn't necessarily think, well, let's put the kitchen sink in there. But what we want from cytotoxic therapy, what we want from biological therapy, and how to combine that, particularly with things like radiation, where as toxicity is obviously a critical issue. You don't want to screw up somebody's opportunity to get to an OR and get fixed, or have terrible strictures or some other problem, bowel perforation. But just as we say bevacizumab may add to capecitabine as a radiation sensitizer, certainly oxaliplatin. I mean, we know the platinums are good radiation sensitizing drugs. These studies need to be done. I think the primary issue is watching the toxicity, seeing how much incremental advance you get. We know that with capecitabine-containing regimens, well, we know with 5-FU-containing regimens, with rectal cancers, typically a T3 situation, T4 lesions, you can achieve a pathologic complete response 20 to 30% of the time. If bevacizumab or oxaliplatin makes that 35, 40%, that's really adding. But I think if you go from 22% to 26%, how much that's making the difference, I'm not certain. But if we really start to see big jumps in the path CR rates or downstaging rates, that's going to be important weaponry. And again, these are systemic agents. So in these patients who have locally advanced rectal cancers, you're giving them a systemic drug on top of radiation sensitizer.
So younger patient, nasty looking, larger rectal lesion, would you use Oxali off study?
I have not done that yet. I think part of it is it's a comfort level as we enroll more patients in our anal cancer trial. And, you know, we're really being told we need to see some downstaging, even for resectability in this patient. Or you have a young woman who's saying, I'd really like a sphincter-preserving kind of approach here. I would be open to considering it. I haven't done that yet. First of all, some data that suggests, yes, this can add in terms of radiosensitization, and two, the toxicity issues might be open to that. I'm not open to that just yet, Neil, but I think it won't be that long. 6 months, a year, I probably would be.
That's really a great study, though. I'm imagining myself 5 years ago thinking about doing a study of something like, you know, capecitabine and bevacizumab with radiation for neoadjuvant therapy. It's really amazing how quickly things have moved, although I guess there have been some exceptions, and one of them I wanted to ask you about is the CONFIRM study of velatinib, which, you know, I guess there was some enthusiasm as an anti-VEGF approach. Can you kind of go through what that was looking at, what that agent is, and what was seen?
Well, the agent is a receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's a oral receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitor, 2-VEGF receptor, has a little more activity against some other tyrosine kinases, but predominantly thinking of it as an anti-VEGF. The trial was designed to see a difference in progression-free survival in patients with previously untreated metastatic colon cancer. Patients were randomized to FOLFOX with or without PTK. PTK was given orally as a once-daily dose. There were two components to defining progression-free survival. There was an investigator determination of progression-free survival based on your review of CT imaging, et cetera, and then there was a central review. The investigator criteria for progression-free survival, actually there was a small statistically significant difference between patients randomized to PTK and those who were not, meaning PTK patients had a slight improvement in progression-free survival based on the investigator's review. However, based on central review, there was no difference there. And overall survival and the real differences between progression-free survival, there was no difference between those patients randomized to PTK and those who were not. Now, interestingly, looking at some subsets of patients, there did seem to be a difference for patients who had a very high LDH pre-therapy. And this really was a striking difference in terms of progression-free survival for patients who had high LDH and who were randomized to PTK. Novartis is considering pursuing studies in those subsets of patients where perhaps high LDH is a surrogate of high VEGF activity, and that tossing in a VEGF inhibitor in that group of patients may make more of a substantial difference than someone who has average VEGF levels, as an example. I'm not certain where that's all going. I will say, and I think most people recognize this, that bevacizumab has set the bar quite high in terms of getting approval for an agent, because small differences in survival between the control arm and the investigational arm is not going to cut it in this day and age. And you're going to need to show at least the kind of benefit that bevacizumab has shown to cross into approval territory, unless you plan to try for second-line indication or third-line indication or some other disease site. But bevacizumab, I think, has set the bar quite high for other biologics that are targeting VEGF.
And it's interesting that when those data were presented at ASCO, it was at the same point, Bruce Giantonio was also presenting the data on the second-line ECOG study showing an advantage to adding bevacizumab to FOLFOX. And one of the things that actually Lee Ellis commented on, because he was the discussant for those two papers, that I was really surprised about was the pharmacokinetics of velatinib, and that you know, it seemed like maybe it didn't really make sense to be given it once a day, which is what was done.
Yeah, I think that's a postulate on his part. It may turn out to be true. I just, you know, when they did these perfusion MRI studies early when looking at PTK, they did this early after exposure. And I think Lee's point is, well, what happens long term? Is this truly a chronicity that continues to be maintained, or does it lose its effectiveness shortly after starting it? And the whole idea of the PKs, and is it a once daily drug or does it need to be twice daily? Again, I'm not certain whether that's going to be pursued. You would like to think if the drug is active, the drug is active. I mean, for instance, one of the advantages of bevacizumab is we know that it does hang around, and you give a dose of that stuff and you're good to go for at least a couple of weeks. Again, people are starting to look at 3-week dosing intervals, et cetera, and this whole idea, well, you better wait a full 6 weeks before you consider surgery. With PTK, obviously, that needs to be a more frequent dosing. That does actually have some advantages in terms of thinking of surgical patients, et cetera. But again, it's not clear to me how they're going to try to develop that drug in the future.
And actually, that kind of circles back to one other thing I wanted to ask you about. We were talking before about bevacizumab and the timing of surgery. I guess in terms of the issue of timing of surgery, you have, A, the issue of wound healing, bowel perforation, but the other thing that was brought up in that editorial is the question of hepatic generation in patients who are having ablation and surgery in the liver. What do we know about hepatic regeneration and bevacizumab?
I don't think we know very much at all, and I think part of the reason is that, by and large, people are off the drug for at least 6 weeks and typically 8 weeks, and at least in our practice, if you've had hepatic surgery, you're waiting a full 4, 6, 8 weeks. I mean, part of that is just clinical, get back on your feet after a hepatic resection. It's always been my sort of understanding that by 4 weeks post-resection, you've reestablished about 95% of the hypertrophy you're going to see for the liver. So after 4 weeks, I think most people would be reasonably comfortable saying, even if you did give bevacizumab, you're not going to be impacting on hepatic regeneration on the back end if you elect to go back to that therapy. How much bevacizumab could be impeding hepatic regeneration because it's hanging around in a low level as people are going to the OR, I don't think we really know. The other important issue, Neil, is that we are starting to recognize there are differences in what irinotecan and what oxaliplatin do to a liver that's going to undergo hepatic resection. Eddie Abdallah in our group, one of our other hepatic surgeons, is doing a great job, has started to look pathologically at normal liver that's been exposed to irinotecan, fluoropyrimidine versus oxaliplatin. Oxaliplatin seems to lead to more of a vascular type injury. Fluoropyrimidine with irinotecan seems to be more of a steatosis. Now, neither of these injuries has had any impact on perioperative complications or on survival. I mean, we haven't seen people having hepatic failure after hepatic resection. But it is interesting that I think clinicians need to recognize there are differences in terms of what these drugs are doing to the liver. It's not necessarily going to change management, but I think clinicians are going to hear about this more moving forward. We are starting to see patients with steatosis. Their liver function studies are often reasonably perturbed with the use of these drugs and after hepatic resection, and this is going to be an area that we need to be cognizant of. The other issue I think we're going to confront is, you know, Americans are, as a group, a fairly unhealthy group of people. This concept of NASH, non-alcoholic steatosis and hepatitis, is a real phenomenon. And people have livers that are not particularly as healthy because of obesity issues, et cetera. How much of a rampant public health problem this is, I'm not certain. But a high body mass index does predict for those kinds of things. And it is something that I know hepatic surgeons are very aware of. And as we give people more, quote-unquote, neoadjuvant therapy prior to hepatic resection, it's something I think we're all going to have to become a little more of a hepatologist.